Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. For good reason, students hold my faculty colleague and guest today, Dr. Darsa Donlan of the Gustavus Physics Department and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies program, who uses the pronouns they, them, in the highest regard. As one student says, Darsa is always doing everything they can to help their students succeed. Another observes, their compassion for their students and their love for teaching is abundantly clear. No surprise, then, that at Honors Day this past spring 2022, Dr. Donlan won the Swenson Bunn Memorial Award for Excellence in Teaching, awarded annually by the Gustavus Student Senate. This was on top of having received in 2021 and 22 the Mark H. Anderson Faculty Diversity Award from the Campus Diversity Leadership Council for her commitment to diversity, inclusion, and social justice. A commitment one student summed up this way: having Darsa on campus has truly made my time at Gustavus memorable through their advocacy for the LGBT plus community and other marginalized groups. Dr. Donlan received her PhD in physics from the University of Florida in 2016 and began teaching at Gustavus that same year. An expert on planetary atmospheres, Professor Donlan has done research with NASA and been awarded a Woman in Physics Group grant from the American Physical Society. In addition to teaching and research, they serve as vice chair of the Gustavus President's Environmental Sustainability Council and have been faculty advisor to numerous student organizations, including currently to the Women, Women with an X in Physics Club, and Queers and Allies. Noteworthy, too, is Dr. Donlan's fascination with science fiction, Star Trek especially, and cosplaying, both of which they incorporate into their teaching to the delight of students and faculty alike. As one department colleague has remarked, the Gustavus Physics Department is the only department on campus that has a Borg as a faculty member. In short, Dr. Donlan is an outstanding science educator and quite interesting person, and I'm delighted they could join me in conversation about their work, science, and personal story. So, Professor Donlan, Darsa, welcome to Learning for Life. It's really great to have you on.
Yes, it's great to be here.
And we were talking before recording. You're just back from a trip to Puerto Rico, so I'm especially grateful that you're taking the time. By the way, I've read nightmares about travel. How was it for you? You said your flight was on time. Was it okay?
Yeah, it was on time. It was okay. I got to fly first class for the first time.
Wow. How was that? On Delta?
On American Airlines.
Oh, on American. Oh, wow. I think I flew first class only twice by accident. Did they call you up or something? Say, like, time to go? Would you like to fly first class?
One of my colleagues was able to upgrade me.
Okay. What's it like up there in first class? Is it really different?
Yeah, they give you these warm towels to wash your face and hands with, and you can have as many beverages as you want. Give you a meal, and everything comes in glass and ceramic containers and cups. And they gave us mixed nuts that there was no peanuts in it. It was all the expensive ones, and they were heated up, so you got a bowl of warm nuts. Jeez.
All right. Stop.
It was amazing.
There's a Seinfeld episode, if I remember correctly, where Jerry's in coach and Elaine is in first class. Just a nightmare for Jerry. Anyway, good for you. Well, welcome back. I thought maybe before we turn to you, your story and your work, talk to us a little bit about what it's been like teaching amid the pandemic. I guess we all had to abandon ship, so to speak, campus that first semester. Have you been teaching online since then? Or, I mean, in person since then is what I meant to say.
Yes, I've been able to teach in person since we've come back. I do incorporate some hybrid learning for the students. I let them have that option of joining virtually at their comfort level, no questions asked. And this has made it so that students keep themselves safe because they might have felt a little sick and were like, right, Better not risk it. I can just join the Zoom. Or they may have gone to a party that weekend and they don't need to tell me what they do on the weekends. But they're like, maybe that party wasn't that safe. I should probably join on Zoom this week.
Yeah.
As well as I would record the lectures for anyone that needed to watch them asynchronously.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much, because of my age and I didn't go back in person until last fall and felt so good. But it was then that I just started regularly recording lectures for students who couldn't be there. Lecture, not just lectures, you know, discussions, the whole bit. I was curious because it'd be hard, I would think, to do how do you do a lab? Did anyone do a lab? Do you know, and any of the scientists on our campus do labs online?
Yes, occasionally we've had to do that, and we found ways to make it work. Okay. It was fairly difficult at the start of the pandemic when we all suddenly got thrusted home.
Yeah.
So we found some simulations that we could use or could make videos of ourselves doing stuff and send data to the students.
Okay.
Once we were able to get back in person, we would occasionally have students that may have to join online. And we found ways to make that work. They could video in and we could do some screen sharing. Prior to that, I had a student that was stuck outside the country for an entire semester.
Oh, yeah, me too, yeah.
Was not able to join lab in person, and we made that work.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, really, not just at Gustavus, but faculty, probably, I guess, around the world, just how creative we've been, the students. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of tired of that word resilient, which I think is overused, but the students, at least the Gustavus students, certainly showed that. I think there's been a lot of stuff written about and said about students and crisis, and I know that's true, but I don't know. The students I had stepped up. I mean, things were, I can't say normal, but, you know, I felt like real learning was occurring, even though I was online until last fall. So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see what some of us who had never taught online before used much digital material. That's me. We'll continue to use even post-pandemic. Let's turn to you first and then get into your work. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up.
Sure. I grew up along the East Coast, a few different places. My parents separated when I was, or they were no longer together by the time I was 1 year old.
Oh, okay.
So my mother was mainly in the Northeast and my father was in the Southeast in Florida.
Oh.
So
what part of the Northeast? I went to grad school in Boston and I love New England and New York.
Yeah. In the New England area. So upstate New York, as well as Western Mass in the Berkshires.
Oh, God, beautiful. So gorgeous. Mm-hmm. There. Yeah. Oh yeah. Because you did we can get into that. You did your BA. Didn't you do your AA and BA in Massachusetts? Yeah. Were your parents scientists at all? Or was anyone in your family?
No, there were no scientists in my family at that time, though my grandmother was a music professor.
Is that your grandmother, Jane? I read about
her. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about her because someone, after you won the Swenson Bunn Award, I think someone posted about how your grandmother, Jane, would be so proud. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah. Oh, my grandmother was so amazing. She was my best friend. We would talk every day. So supportive. When my sisters and I were younger, she had given us all these posters that we had decorated our walls with about accomplished women in history.
Oh, that's cool.
And just really made sure that we knew that we could do anything. And she started all these great initiatives at her college. She was amazing. She wrote three books.
Wow. What where was she teaching? What college?
North Adams State College.
Oh, sure. Of course. Yeah.
Which is now the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts.
Right. Was she, it's where you went, right? Didn't you go there?
That's where I went. Yeah.
BA and BS in physics and BA in math. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What? That's neat. Did she have a particular interest or specialty? I mean, was it her voice or instruments?
Instruments. Okay. Yeah. Trombone.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Those role models are so important. My wife, Kate, who became a historian and taught in the history department until her retirement at Gustavus. She had some great aunts. I remember one great aunt made her a quilt. The same kind of thing, a quilt. And it was, each patch was, I think, had the name of a, you know, important woman in history. All those things matter. That's neat. Thank you. Because I wondered who was, I even Googled her, tried to find out, and I didn't get very far because there was too many Jane Donnellans, but if that's even her last name.
Jane LePage.
Okay. Yeah. Is she still living or not? Is she still here?
No, she passed away when I was in undergrad.
Okay. And then was she on your mom's or dad's side?
On my mother's side.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool. And then, it sounds like you have triplet sisters. Is that true? Did I misread that?
Yeah, I'm a triplet.
Wow. And then any brothers at all or not?
Yep. I also have some brothers.
Wow. So big family, it sounds like five or more?
More.
Okay. And did any of your siblings pursue science, or are you the only one out there?
Yes. My older brother, he has a PhD in medical biology.
Oh, cool.
And my youngest sister, that we have a 14-year age gap, she recently finished her bachelor's in biomedical engineering.
Oh, wow. That's neat. That's a field. I was talking to maybe Becky Bergman, our president, Gustavus president, someone I was talking to about. I think it might have been Becky, that biomedical engineering. Neat. So what got you interested in science? When and how did you become interested in science?
Well, my grandmother definitely had a big role letting me know all the time that I could do anything that I wanted. And when I told her that how I was very interested in physics and astrophysics and cosmology, and there was this, during this time I was in undergrad and I wanted to pursue a graduate degree, she went and did all this research to figure out which schools would be a good fit for me and look into their backgrounds and understanding as much about the field as she could without being an expert in the mathematics or anything.
That's cool.
That was really special. Star Trek was also important.
Well, yeah, I wondered about. I assume so. Yeah. How old were you? What year would you have been watching? I was watching. I have vivid memories of the original Star Trek, which I then. I mean, I watched all of it. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was a kid. I was very young. Well, Next Generation was on.
Okay.
That there's episodes there. I thought that Data and Geordi were really cool, and there was an episode that focused on Wesley and some other kids his age that were in the program and doing really well, and they got to be with Picard for the day, and they got stuck in the elevator shaft and everything. And I was like, yeah, I want to be like those kids. Then with Voyager, where we had Captain Janeway,
right?
That came out at the right time for me. And Janeway rose to the rank of captain through science rather than through command.
So, yes, that's a great point. Right. And you were, were you in high school then or college? I'm trying to think how old you would have been when that came out. You said it came out at the right time for you.
Came out at the right time. Yeah. Let's see.
You were probably trying to think what year that would have been. But
well, it started in 95 and went on for 2 years. So middle school and high school.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. High school for sure. Yeah. Pre-college. Yeah, it's interesting. The you know, I was wondering, I was going to ask you, you've answered kind of what were, and maybe there were some other influences too. What led you to your interest in astronomy and cosmology? The thing I remember about the original Star Trek was a good friend across the yard. This was in Park Forest, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. And their family had a color TV before I did. So this must have been in the 60s. And I just remember going over and watching Star Trek in color. You know, it's like, oh my God, this is so, so cool. And as a kid, I don't know why I didn't become a scientist. Actually, as a kid, I read the Hardy Boys, which some of us read, kind of like the Nancy Drew for boys, but I really was into Tom Swift. I should go back to, I think that's what he was called. These are sort of sci-fi. They were sci-fi books, about, you know, the future. And I just loved, I thought I'd be an astronaut, you know, with a, the Mercury program and playing astronaut as they went up, like, you know, going and dressing up like an astronaut. I was crazy. I should maybe go into class as an astronaut one day like you do, with some costumes. But that's interesting. So your grandmother and also Star Trek. Then were you already taking courses did they have physics courses in high school where you were?
Yes, there was a physics course in my high school that I did take.
Okay.
And I performed very well in it. So.
And to be, I mean, I guess to be this is an ignorant question, I guess, but to be an astronomer, you must be a physicist. Is that true? The two just go together?
You don't, not necessarily. Well, they're related, but there's a lot of fields that directly will relate to physics or other fields of science.
Okay.
But there is some overlap in the field, what we call astrophysics.
Astrophysics, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that what's his name? Neil deGrasse Tyson. I read him. And
mm-hmm. That is correct.
And for me, I guess growing up for me, it was, what's his name? Carl Sagan. Thank God, blanking his name. Carl Sagan. Yeah, exactly. Because I think he had a show called Cosmos, right?
I remember watching.
So you go on. So by the time you get to college, it sounds like you knew you wanted to major in physics and math.
At least partway. I started initially going for art.
Oh, that's right. Because you did the AA. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Right.
Yeah, I love making art and painting, and I was voted most artistic in high school and got some awards through the art department. And even when I was getting my associates in art, I won several awards for my work.
Wow. And that was at Berkshire Community College, right?
That's correct.
I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So beautiful, kind of gorgeous. My wife's great aunt, one of her great aunts had a place near Tanglewood. That was so beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she would rent it out, you know. But, excuse me. So what kind of art were you doing? I mean, you said painting, but I mean of the cosmos or?
people. I like doing figure painting. Painting people is just very interesting.
Are you still doing that for fun or?
When I can find the time, it is harder to find the time.
Yeah.
But I would sometimes be... When I was doing those classes, I was the only art major that was taking physics courses and Calc 2. And I started painting equations into the backgrounds of my paintings.
That's great. Have you ever shown them at Gustavus at all? Any kind of show or anything?
I have not.
Oh, you should. I know I'm not supposed to say should, but you should. That'd be cool. Or put them online, maybe your webpage or something.
Yeah. I did paint a mural at Gustavus.
Oh, really? Which one?
It's outside of the Center for Inclusive Excellence.
Oh, my gosh. Of course. I've seen that. Yeah. Wow.
So I did that with the Radicals,
yeah,
which is our social justice art group. And
right.
I painted the Nebula.
That's awesome. I didn't realize you did both. You're good. Maybe I'm just fantasizing here. My dad used to paint for fun. He was a hairdresser, but he did paint. He told us he went to the Art Institute. I never know if that's true, but he grew up in Chicago. Anyway, so I grew up with lots of paintings and art. And my dad would say, I'm having a painting fit, and he'd leave early and go paint. But, that's neat. The, when you said you include some equations and you were the only art student or whatever, taking physics, you were an early version of STEAM, right? Whatever
that's. Yeah.
Science, technology, engineering, art, and math. There you go. You were a pioneer. Yeah. So by the time you graduate, did you know right away? I mean, already your senior year, were you applying to graduate school? You knew you wanted to go on for the PhD?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Were there particular teachers in your undergraduate institution who influenced you or mentored you?
Yeah. Yeah. I was very fortunate at my undergrad where a majority of my physics teachers were women.
Really? Wow. That must have been unusual.
Yeah. Well, we were a very small college, smaller than Gustavus. And there was three faculty in the physics department and two were women. Wow. So there was Dr. Emily Marr and Dr. Adrian Wooters, and they had a huge role for me, especially seeing them and like, oh, yes, this is completely normal.
Right. So. It's so important. I mean, that's so important when you talk about visibility or the presence of people who look like one, are like one, how important that is. That's really neat. I obviously didn't know about that. And that was, again, that was the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in North Adams. How small was, you said smaller than Gustavus. I don't really know how small was it?
Well, my graduating class just for physics students was three people.
That's small. Yeah.
And I think the year before us, it was just one person graduating with a physics degree.
Wow. I was at Boston, where I met my wife, Kate, Boston University, I don't know if it's just the largest private university. And then I went to a big state school, Northern Illinois University. But my wife went to a small liberal arts college, Bard College in upstate New York. But you had that liberal arts experience there. You're lucky. So are you in touch with those women still or not? Are they still living? Are you?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. I talk with Dr. Marr a lot.
That's neat. I'm sure they're very proud of you. I still speak with a lot of us do a high school. We Zoom with him, a high school history teacher who had such an influence on so many of us over generations who, in fact, I podcasted with him not that long ago, finally, who's, I think, 90, you know, and still just an enormous influence on all of us. His approach to life and history and Russian history in particular, which isn't my field, but interests me nonetheless. So the role of mentors, and you're doing that, of course, as a teacher now, as a professor now. So why Florida? Your dad was there. I mean, was that the place your grandmother said, this is for you, this really has the great physics program? Or why the University of Florida for the PhD?
Yeah. So there, part of that was to be closer to my family in Florida, my father, my stepmother, and my older brother got his PhD from the University of Florida, and he was a grad student there when I started. Okay. So we had several years of overlap. Yeah. So there was part of that was having somebody that I know around there. My brother and I lived together while I was in grad school. And it was just nice to, grad school is hard, and just having family there and a support system was very nice. And I had also done an REU, which is a research experience for undergrads at the University of Florida when I was an undergrad.
Oh, okay. So there were lots of good reasons for you to be there. It's fine. My brother and I roomed together at Northern Illinois University when we were undergraduates. That was a mistake. We love each other, but oh my God, that was a rough semester. But yeah, graduate school. I don't know if all Gustavus students or undergraduates generally understand how tough graduate school can be. It can be so different from what they experience at Gustavus, at least in the humanities. I assume it's probably similar in the sciences. But you're correct me if I'm wrong. In the intro, I said your expertise or your area is planetary atmospheres. Is that accurate? And if so, what does that involve? Accurate. Okay, thanks. What does that involve, and how did you come to that?
I knew I absolutely wanted to do something with space. And when I first started grad school, I actually worked for a different advisor on a different project, which was, the project was called LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. And it's a space-based telescope, or space-based satellite that uses lasers as a ruler to measure gravitational waves. So that's if you have something in space anything that has mass and is accelerating produces a ripple in space-time. But any ripple that we would produce would be far too small to measure. But if we have something sufficiently large enough, like a black hole or a neutron star, then we can make those measurements. Now, the measurements are actually very tiny, smaller than the width of a human hair. Wow. So what I worked on was reducing the noise level in lasers so that they're like the noise floor would be higher than what we want to measure. So okay. I would have to bring it lower. And I worked on that for the first half of grad school and even was able to work off campus for a little over a year, about a year and a half, in just outside DC at Goddard Space Flight Center.
Oh, gee, wow, that must have been amazing.
Yeah. And then unfortunately, there was budget cuts at the federal level, and a lot of projects that was working with between NASA and the European Space Agency, such as this project, had lost funding. And NASA cut the budget on this one. And then the European Space Agency was stuck with all of these projects that they could not fund because they needed it to be a joint funding. So they lumped things into groups of three and said, we're going to pick one of these to continue funding. And mine was in the same group as Kepler, which is an exoplanet transit mission.
Okay.
Nobody was going to beat Kepler. And that, you know, people are still working on the LISA project, but it's,
yeah, well, I was going to ask you
about main that. Chunk okay. of funding was gone.
It's gone. Yeah.
So I had no funding to stay at in Maryland, working at Goddard. So it meant I'd have to go back to University of Florida, but I have everything in a government facility there. I can't just bring that back. And, my first advisor told me, well, I don't have anything for you, so I guess that's it. And yeah, so I was like, is my graduate career over?
Yeah.
And I left his office, went to my car, and spent about 5 minutes crying.
Yeah.
Called my bestie. And then I was like, okay, I went inside, I washed off my face. And within half an hour after he told me that I was no longer his grad student, I found a new advisor and a new project.
Wow. That's an incredible story. Yeah. And an important story for, you know, prospective students, current students, mm-hmm. students thinking about graduate school to hear. That's amazing. So yeah. Who was the new advisor?
Yep. Dr. Katya Macheva. Yeah, she was fantastic. She really took me in, and that's when I started working in planetary atmospheres, okay. and I just fell in love with it. She really provided me with so much support and was very understanding when my sister had a child, and then my brother had a child, and I needed to help them out occasionally with childcare. And I would say, well, here's when I'm going to be watching my sister's kid while she's at work. And then when my sister would come home, then I would go to the office and work. And like, that was okay with her.
Wow. You were lucky to have the number of yeah. women mentors you had. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, my high school physics teacher was also a woman. So.
Yeah, no, that's something. So what is, I mean, I think I kind of know in a very general or vague way, but tell us a little bit about what your research involves, and if you can, in layperson yeah. terms.
Sure. So the work I did in grad school, I was investigating the atmosphere of Titan, which is Saturn's largest moon. And there, when the Cassini mission that
oh, yeah.
was launched to go investigate Saturn and its moons went out towards Saturn, it also had a probe on it, the Huygens probe, which was specifically designed to be released and go through Titan's atmosphere to record data. It had been known for a while that Titan had a very substantial atmosphere, very terrestrial.
Oh, that's interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm. So it was something that we really wanted to study. The atmosphere is very thick. And when it was so interesting, and people wanted to look at it, that when the Voyager missions were sent out to go look at at planets and moons. Voyager 2 was sent to go past Titan. And based on where the planets were aligned at that time, this meant that it would it wasn't going to be in the path of other planets like Uranus. And so that was going to be something, well, you can't see that. You have to use the other Voyager mission for that. But the Voyager is getting ready to go past Titan, and everyone's like, yeah, we're going to get a nice picture of Titan. We're going to see what's in that on its surface, because we knew it had a thick atmosphere, and everyone wondered what's below its atmosphere. Sure. Is there land? Is it a global ocean? And this would be like a global ocean of ethane. And they went, they took a picture, and it looked like a fuzzy orange ball. Because they were using the visible spectrum and all the methane in the atmosphere of Titan, you would have to use the infrared.
Oh, no. Wow.
Well, they had already made predictions about what was in the atmosphere. So that was like, oh, come on. Then with the Hubble Space Telescope, after it got fixed, it was able to turn and look at Titan. And it was using the infrared. And we saw these dark and light spots. So
right, I remember reading about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That meant not a global ocean. So now it's even more interesting to peer past that atmosphere and see what's on the surface. The Cassini mission took many beautiful pictures. And the Huygens probe also had a camera. And as it fell through the atmosphere, it collected data, and that was the data that I used for my PhD thesis. Okay. And then it landed on the surface, which kind of looks a lot like Arizona. yeah, so there has like methane rocks and methane in the atmosphere. Its atmosphere is predominantly nitrogen, like Earth's atmosphere, but then instead of oxygen, it has methane, and it's a very, very thick atmosphere, very substantial, and very Earth-like. It has different sections like Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Thank you. That's kind of what I remember reading, Earth, quote-unquote, Earth-like. Yeah.
Earth-like, yes. So Earth, we have a troposphere, stratosphere, mesosphere, and thermosphere. Same thing on Titan. So I created an algorithm to make a model atmosphere for Titan. And I was investigating how a certain type of energy wave, which we call gravity waves, different from gravitational waves. So my first project in grad school is on gravitational waves. Now I'm looking at gravity waves.
Gravity waves.
It's because gravity is a restoring force, much like when you drop a rock in a pond, you get ripples.
Right.
So gravity is restoring that water back to equilibrium. If you vertically disturb an atmosphere, there's going to be waves, these energy waves that transport through the atmosphere, and eventually the waves will break and deposit this energy and momentum into the upper atmosphere.
Okay.
So I was investigating what was happening there. I used a type of analysis where I would take the data and run it through this algorithm. And that algorithm suggested that, oh, we should have these gravity waves in the atmosphere at these certain locations. This is where it starts. This is where it ends. But then to make sure that this algorithm was in fact correct, I then created a model atmosphere of Titan where I put in that data and certain boundary conditions that would make sense for a gravity wave versus an acoustic wave, which they have different parameters to define how those would work. And it matched the algorithm.
It matched.
Yep.
So that's a good moment, I guess. Or is it,
that was
is
a
it
good not, moment.
It is a good moment. Yeah. I was wondering if a better moment would be, oh, they don't match. Aha. I don't know.
Yeah. It was basically my prediction matched the model.
Yeah. Well, that's all. And so is your work primarily focused on Titan still, or do you look at other?
I look at other things now. Yeah. Okay. So I have had students at Gustavus where we went back to looking at gravity waves, and we looked at, I showed them how I did stuff on Titan, and then we looked at Venus and Mars as well. But I've also been getting into radio astronomy with some students on campus through a citizen science project through NASA. That's called great. Radio Jove.
Wow.
Yep.
NASA, I mean, you've done research with NASA and so much really interesting stuff. I've read a little bit about it, just the educational stuff you've done with NASA. Is that for college and high school kids both?
Yep, that is correct.
Yeah, that's right. You really are a science educator. God knows we need those. That's a whole other podcast, maybe. Here we are, by the way, talking about, I mean, not quite the same, but talking about planetary or bodies and atmospheres, as the Supreme Court has, you know, basically gutted the EPA's ability to do anything with our our atmosphere. I don't know. Oh, gosh, another podcast. But so with Gustavus, how did you come from the PhD to here? You finished your PhD in 16, as I said in the intro, and were you on the job market? How did it work?
Yes. Yeah, so while I was in grad school, I made a point to tell everyone what I was looking for. I'm like, I want to be an educator. I want to work at a small liberal arts college. I want to be able to have control over what I teach and create laboratory modules and all of that. The person whose position that who retired and I filled emailed somebody at the University of Florida saying, "Hey, I'm retiring and we have a job opening. Here's the information in case you know anybody."
That's great.
So that person forwarded the email to me, and I didn't immediately apply because I was like, "Oh, Minnesota, that sounds cold."
Yeah, you were right. So,
yeah, I sat on it for a few weeks, and then I'm like, I was hearing stories from my fellow classmates about how they sent out hundreds of applications and they haven't heard back and they're just trying to find a job. And I'm like, I guess I should start doing this. So I filled out the application, sent it in, thinking, all right, at least I have this stuff written. So then it'll be easier to apply for other things. I had no expectations. But the day after I sent out my application, I got a response. I got a phone call from my colleague, my current colleague, Paul Sonier.
Sure.
Doing a phone interview. And then I did another phone interview. Then I got asked to come for an in-person interview. And the day after I got back from that interview, I got a phone call from Provost Brenda Kelly offering me the job.
That's fantastic. I love that story. And also the story about how you, you know, with your first advisor in the PhD program, because we historians, I don't know if scientists talk about contingencies. We like to talk about contingency in history and, you know, this might have happened, but for this, or I guess related to counterfactual too, but, you know, what, you know, you might not be studying planetary atmospheres original program had lost
that
its
is funding, true.
Right. Yeah. And then the way you know, I just think it's illuminating how people come to do what they do. I grew up in the burbs of Chicago, as I think I said, and I had not heard of Gustavus. I was at a convention in New York City, a big history convention, saw an ad posted and said, "This is me, my God." But I asked my mentor, you know, what he knew about the place. And he mentioned two famous U.S. historians, Jim McPherson, who's a great Civil War historian of our time, and Sidney Ahlstrom, who's one of my mentor's professors at Yale, one of his mentors. Anyway, and I thought, my God, what? Yes, I want to go to that place. But that leads me to ask you, did you know much about the physics department before applying? I mean, it's always had such a fine reputation as one of the you know, top liberal arts college physics departments.
I knew nothing about the physics department, and I had, after I got the, I was getting called for interviews, and I had told my advisor. She actually went to go to the physics department website at Gustavus, and she was looking, and the picture has all men.
Yes.
And she was like, I'm kind of worried about you for this because I don't want there to be problems.
Yeah.
Neither of us knew anything about these men, but just seeing this picture.
Right. It's like looking at the Supreme Court not that long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so what made you had that kind of worry, you and your advisor, trepidation, whatever concern, mm-hmm. what tipped it for you? Was it just, this is a job and my peers aren't getting jobs, or was there something?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I was like, I need a job.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how, I certainly felt that way. And then they were able to offer, as I said, I was also excited to know these two great historians had gone there. But then they also offered Kate, a position. Well, actually, no, they offered us a position, I should say. We were sharing a position for a time, which made us lucky. So related to that concern, what is it you identify as non-binary? What is it like to be in, and I don't know if you're the, we were talking beforehand, maybe not the first woman in the department, but it's still, I would imagine it's still a mostly male field, mm-hmm. physics, even though you had some incredible women mentors, you're lucky. What's it been like for you? I mean, was that concern borne out or not?
Well, sometimes it's very quietly devastating.
Yeah.
It is tough. I definitely see a lot of students coming to me with concerns that they would not go to my colleagues for.
Sure.
There is so much invisible labor.
Yeah. Right. That's a whole part of, right, for lots of faculty, right, to whom mm-hmm. students turn when they can't turn to others. Yeah. Invisible, unpaid. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is it like for women physics majors at Gustavus? I mean, I'm asking you to generalize. Do most of them go on to, I mean, are they being inspired the way you were? They're going on to graduate school. How many women majors do you even have, I guess I should ask?
Yeah, we do have our women are going on to grad school. And we work very hard to make sure that they see themselves as scientists, because they are.
Right.
And there are going to be hurdles. I certainly had hurdles when I was in grad school, where my high school physics teacher was a woman. Most of my undergrad physics teachers were women. So I hadn't experienced the sexism side of physics until I got to grad school. And I got hit hard.
Yeah, that must have been really difficult. Mm-hmm. How did that manifest itself? Just sort of, I mean, condescension or worse?
Well, some of the experience would range from brutal harassment to just years of subtle slights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awful. I was just reading, I was reading about a woman in business, a woman in business who just wrote about how hard she had to work to prove herself, work. And then kind of some of the costs of that in terms of family life, you know, deciding not to have a family, for example. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. But yeah, that point about invisible labor, that's really important. We got to work on that somehow, make that not only visible, but remunerated, paid, for God's sakes. But I'm glad to hear women, I'm trying to think, I've known just a few women physics majors over the years, but I'm glad to hear that they're identifying as scientists or encouraged to, and indeed go on to graduate school. So you are, and I'm not just saying this, it's the truth. You are a phenomenal teacher. Everyone knows that. And certainly the department is, Gustavus, lucky to have you. What is it? I mean, how did you come to be such a terrific teacher? I mean, what are the ingredients of your own effective teaching, would you say?
Yeah, I've been asked that. And sometimes I'm not entirely sure, because I'm like, I don't know, it just sort of happened.
Yeah.
But I do... I work very closely with the American Association of Physics Teachers and serve in some leadership roles with them. So that's helped me just staying up to date with all the current literature on physics education. And I'm able to implement these pedagogical techniques in peer instruction.
Yes.
I'll use classroom-based questioning techniques where I'll make a combination of conceptually challenging multiple choice questions and classroom feedback. And it's all designed to increase student-to-student discourse. And it provides insight into the students' learning, not only for myself, but also for the students.
Sure.
Yeah. And most of the questions that I've developed for my courses, they do follow peer-reviewed tutorials that emphasize the development of important physical concepts and scientific reasoning skills, and not just the standard quantitative problems that are found in traditional textbooks.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Even in history, too, there's this emphasis, at least in our department, I think more so on you know, historical thinking, like you can know everything about the past. Well, you can't, but let's imagine you could, everything about the past, but that doesn't mean you have any historical understanding if you don't know how to think historically. Mm-hmm. What I like about you, you as a teacher, is you've got the passion for your subject matter, obviously that comes through, but you also understand, and work at constantly. I mean, you make that clear in some of the comments I read by you about your teaching, that teaching is, it's a craft, it's a skill, it's a practice, right? And that you mm-hmm. don't just show up in the classroom with your knowledge and then, you know, on the sage on the stage or whatever. That's neat that you're involved with that organization. The other thing you do, of course, that you're well known for, as I mentioned in the intro, is the costumes, the cosplaying. How did you come to do that? Were you already doing that even before Gustavus?
Yes, I was. It's actually pronounced cosplay.
Cosplay, okay.
Like thank costume
you.
Play.
Costume play, yeah. Okay, yeah. Cosplay, yeah, cosplay. Thank you.
Yeah, so, I would attend sci-fi conventions when I was in grad school, It's really fun to dress up as these characters that you just love watching. Some might be because they're an inspiring character, and sometimes it's just because they look so cool. Or for me, with the Borg.
Right.
The Borg, they are collective, and I'm like, well, I'm a triplet, so I guess I'm part of a collective. And there'd be times when I would just wish I could be more like the Borg, where I want this knowledge, I'm just going to assimilate it. And I don't have to worry about the struggles and all these emotions that come along with it. I can just be like, absorb knowledge, good, have knowledge. And just there'd be times when I, in grad school, where it'd be so hard. And I'd be like, why can't I just be like the Borg?
And why the Borgs come out of Star Trek, right?
Is that feelings? Right? Yep.
The Borgs come out of Star Trek? Am I
remember? Yes, they do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, all right. So, but were you, when did you start incorporating that into your teaching? Was it only at Gustavus, or had you done?
Oh, gosh. When I worked at Goddard, I'd actually go in dressed up as a Vulcan at times. I'd wear a Star Trek uniform and have Vulcan ears on.
Wonderful. And what was the reaction of your colleagues?
I mean, it was a bunch of scientists, so they're just like, yeah, seems right.
Whatever. That's cool.
Yeah, but then I've had a lot more opportunities at Gustavus to dress up for specific occasions and different things. So.
Right. Do the students know? I guess the students know about Star Trek, at least the I don't know. I wonder how many of them know about the original Star Trek. Do you know? Have any idea?
They are aware that the original series exists, they, as far as other Star Treks, they're very much aware of it. I have a lot of students that love Star Trek, and we've watched Star Trek together and binged through stuff.
Yeah.
I've actually recently had some editors were asking for essay proposals for a book on Star Trek and feminism.
Oh, wow.
So
that's perfect for you.
Yeah, I wrote a proposal with a student that was the president of Queers and Allies who just graduated, not That's a fantastic. Physics major, but we co-wrote a proposal and it got accepted. So
oh, wow. Congratulations.
We will have our RSA in a book.
That's fantastic. Do you know when the book will come out or what its title will be?
Space, the Feminist Frontier.
Of course. That's fantastic. Oh, I'm excited for you. Congratulations. Yeah. Plus the collaboration.
Yeah. Our essays due the 31st of August. So I'll assume sometime after that.
Yeah. But, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Wonderful. The, it's funny talking, I'm having some flashbacks, if that's the right term, to Star Trek. One of the things that always, at least, I'm talking about the original Star Trek, you know, what I found very odd, never quite understood, is like the future, you know, wherever they were, looked like, it didn't look modern to me, if that makes any sense. I mean, they're always rocks. You know what I mean? I never understood that part. You don't have to answer this. It's just an or comment if you like, but it's just an observation. That bugged me because
rocks.
Yeah, I know. In my mind, there would be some kind of like futuristic cities, you know, something, you know, but it was, you know what I mean? It looked like wherever they were, whatever planet, whatever galaxy, it looked like, good Lord, that's the future. What's scientific about any of that? It just looks, I mean, maybe the people had powers or look different, but the landscape, I guess, is what I'm talking about. I could never quite relate to the landscape of the future in that show, at least in the original.
Well, I mean, we are looking for strange new worlds, and what might be considered futuristic and progressive for one species may not be the same for another, or they've moved around at different things and different paces, or maybe they've reverted back because, I think we've seen some post-apocalyptic work before.
Yeah, no, that's what I think that's one of the things that bothered me growing up as a baby boomer and thinking, okay, this looks like what might happen if there's a nuclear war, or what you said a while ago, was it Uranus? Were you talking, what looked like Arizona? That landscape.
Titan.
Titan. Thank you. It was Titan. That's what I was always thinking. Like, what am I looking at? This looks like, you know, Arizona or whatever, the desert.
Anyway. Yeah.
But that show, I mean, had a profound impact on me, even though I didn't go on to wear costumes, certainly, as I say, except for plain astronaut. So when you're in the classroom, I saw a little video which instantly made me want to be in your class. You're I don't know how to describe it. You're holding something spherical, and then it goes up and becomes larger. Do you know what I'm talking about? That video, and the students are oohing and aahing. You're doing some demo. It's spinning.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. What is that about?
Yeah. So I think that you might be talking about an angular momentum.
Yeah.
Conservation of angular momentum demo.
Yeah, so, that's what it was. Thank you.
Yeah, it's like that plastic ball. Yep. Okay. So conservation of angular momentum is something that we could see on Earth with something like an ice skater. An ice skater spins in a circle, and they may put their arms in. They're going to spin faster. Part of that has to do with they reduced how wide their spread was, so then their speed increases.
Okay.
Now, we have the same thing happen in solar system formation and stars. So a star will be born from just a ball of dust and gas that starts to collapse in on itself. Usually something triggered it, like a shockwave. And as that collapses in on itself, and it'll have a spin to it. It gets smaller and spins faster and smaller and spins faster and heats up and eventually forms a star. And any bits of dust and gas that do not clump in to form the star will flatten out like when you spin pizza, and then that disk will have things that can clump together and eventually form our planets. And that's how you make a star in a solar system.
That is so cool. How do you develop these pedagogical techniques? Are you learning from other people's examples, or you're sort of imagining doing these things, you know, your off hours, so to speak, bit of both?
A little bit of both. So I certainly read up on things, but then I do think about stuff often, and I'll be sitting there talking to family or friends about stuff, and then suddenly I'll be like, oh, this might be a cool thing for that. And this is where my background in art,
yes,
I think, plays a very good role.
Yes,
because
definitely.
I'm able to think creatively.
Yep. You're literally taking the words out of my mouth. I think teaching for me, one of the reasons I love teaching, I think I probably would have loved, I love going to the theater. I don't know if I'm maybe too shy to be an actor, but I'd love performance. Theatrical performance, especially. I think there's an element of that. And teaching is so creative, at least the best teaching. And we are, you know, we're the stars, the producers, the directors, the script writers, the whole bit. But anyone listening who is pondering coming to Gustavus and majoring in physics, see that video, because it's really cool. And to hear students oohing, aahing. This is just great. I love it. I just happened upon that when I was doing some prep for our conversation. So in addition to your teaching, your awesome teaching, you're also doing a heck of a lot of advising. And we don't have time, unfortunately, to talk about all of the groups, the Radicals, A Moment of Magic. But I want to talk especially about your work with Queers and Allies. Just talk to us a little bit about that group and your work with them as faculty advisor.
Wow, I love that group, which is why I'm co-writing an essay with the recent alumni presidents of the group. It's so important to have a space and a group of people that you can be yourself around. And we create that. We're finding that there are more and more people identifying as LGBTQIA+, and maybe at home for them, it's not safe to be themselves, but we have a place for them here and a group, and they belong, and that's so important. And we just have a lot of fun too. We do our drag shows and I perform in them. It's just great. I just love those students so much.
It's really incredibly important. I'm in I got a little certificate. So I finished my 35th year at Gustavus, which I can't believe. And it was, both Kate and I, we came from Boston in, what would that have been, 86. But Gustavus was, you know, not unique in this regard, although a little different than what we were experiencing in Boston, a major city, but it was incredibly closeted. I mean, just unbelievably closeted. And I remember we went to a meeting, probably by the student, you know, whatever, the dean of students, whoever it was, whatever their name was, at the time, where there was a Lutheran gay minister and students who were, you know, unable to, for good reasons, to come out, who didn't have that space that Queers and Allies now provides. And so for people who think, you know, nothing ever changes, that's just not true, right? There's still work, of course, but it's a different place. It's such a different place for the good, as far as I'm concerned. So that's satisfying work. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is you've been doing this for a while, I think, right? The President's Environmental Sustainability Council at Gustavus. What's that about? Tell us, and what's your role in that?
Yeah, I'm the, the vice chair?
Vice chair, yes. That's what I said in my intro, so it must be true.
Yeah, sometimes I forget what all my titles are.
Yeah, well, you're busy, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, so we really work to incorporate sustainability initiatives on campus, and there's so many different aspects that we could do. We want to be zero waste. We have to think about transportation. We have to think about composting, communication on campus, infrastructure. There's so much. So we have our own little groups in there so that it's not one person trying to take care of everything, but it's a lot easier to get something done when you're like, well, here's all the things we want to do. I'll focus on this part. other people are focusing on other parts, and then we can come together. Yes. We can make sense where things overlap. But we really are trying, because it's very important. And now, especially with the rollbacks on the EPA.
Right. Like, More so than ever.
This is our planet.
Yes.
Like, the conditions that had to be just right for us to have this, I could preach about that. But it's special, and not enough people treat the planet with dignity and respect.
No, it's so true. I have one more question about that council, but before I do, yes, I want to underscore what you just said. I think sometimes the climate change is to, I mean, I'm generalizing to at least some current students, what the prospect of nuclear annihilation was to my generation. Of course, that's still a prospect for us. That hasn't gone away. And it's just unbelievable. It's maddening to me, absolutely maddening, that a handful of people, I'm referring to the Supreme Court now, the conservative majority, can, you know, in effect, not just roll us back, but I mean, hasten the extinction of the planet. You know, it's crazy to me, because I remember going to hear, I don't know if you've ever heard of Barry Commoner, who was an ecologist and a reformer, and, you know, reading Rachel Carson, and this, you know, the amount of, I'm on a rant now, sorry, I'll stop in a second, but, you know, the amount of work that goes into achieving just the smallest bit of progress, and then to have that undermined is incredibly discouraging. But we push on, at least we try to. So with that said, what's the progress report for the council? How do things stand at Gustavus? Obviously there's more work to do, but give us your sense of where we stand. Yeah.
We're doing all right. There were some of our goals about when we wanted to be zero waste that we've had to push back a little, which was due to the pandemic. There were just some things that we wanted to do that we couldn't do because we did not know enough about COVID, and sure, we had to make sure everybody was safe.
Right.
But we're getting back into things, and I think that we can meet a zero waste goal within the next few years.
Yeah, and well, you're just reminding me, one of the things I read about you somewhere, you were saying how you, and you know, even encouraging students to turn off the lights.
Oh yeah.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here. I was so happy to read that, because I go around doing that, and sometimes I think, why am I bothering? But I remember during the so-called energy crisis, this is during when Jimmy Carter was president. You know, I remember at Boston University, maybe it was at Northern too, I think it was at Boston University, you know, there would be the, on every light switch, right? Turn off, mm-hmm, right? Just turn off the lights. And now we, I don't know, maybe all the lights go off automatically and we don't need to worry about it. But that bugs me when I see all those lights on and no one is in the classroom. How hard is it to erase the board and turn off the lights when you leave? In any case, we're winding down here. So this has been really fun. I want to ask you finally about, sciences. God knows, under attack. I mean, education is under attack from so many quarters now. But what's your pitch? You went to a liberal arts college. What's your pitch for science, physics in particular, if you like, but and the liberal arts? And Gustavus in particular, I guess, since that's where you are.
Yes. Well, we need to make science itself more diverse, equitable, and open to all. And anyone is welcome to take my classes. My courses, they're not designed just to get everyone into astrophysics, though that'd be nice. But they're designed to create scientifically literate citizens.
Yes, so important. I have a stack of books on, I think one of which you might have assigned. Or no, what was the book you led the reading club? There was a reading club. Remember that book? What was that book called that you did with faculty? I think might have been, I'm blanking on the title.
Are you thinking about Superior?
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Right. I have that book. I want to read that. I wasn't able to join the group, but I have it. I bought it because of the group.
So
scientific
good.
Literacy. Yeah, it sounds great. And maybe I'll actually meet you for coffee or something once I get to it. The importance of scientific literacy to citizenship. It's just amazing to me. Having grown up when it was all about science because of the Cold War and the so-called space race, to have the kind of, I don't know, it feels like, you know, beyond, it's just hard for me to get my head around the kind of antipathy toward science and scientific thinking. What is it about a place like Gustavus that you think is valuable for students?
Well, we are a liberal arts college. And I love that. Everyone has a place that they fit in. And science does not just happen in a silo. We need policymakers. We need the arts. We need everyone.
Yeah, we need the liberal arts.
We need the liberal arts.
We need everyone. I completely agree. And I think that, you know, just thinking about COVID and not just the previous administration, even to some extent the current administration, just how the government, I mean, yeah, you need the researchers, God knows, and it's amazing, the vaccines, all of that, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. But you also need, you know, sociologists and psychologists and artists and others to figure out, and policymakers for sure, how to get this stuff out, how to get the message out, how to persuade people, convince people. So I think, yeah, the liberal arts, it seems to me, are more important than ever. And by the way, one of the things I have a strong memory of going to graduate school in Boston is occasionally seeing some, and this was true, some, and still true, faculty at scientists at Gustavus, but I was thinking of Dick Fuller now, I was a former member of your department long ago, but people who are scientists, but also, you know, profoundly humanists at the same time. I remember going to some talks by some scientists at MIT just for fun, you know, just because I was interested. And they were conversant on policy and in ways that I so admire. So, here's to the liberal arts and physics, of course. So one final question, do you have a hankering to go into space? I mean, if, you know,
yes.
Bezos, yes, the answer is yes. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah. Any thoughts about our billionaire space explorers at this point?
Well, I mean, some of what they've done hasn't really been that exciting, scientifically speaking. There are cool things like reusable rockets. That's great. But yeah, I've got some opinions about them that would include some expletives.
Yeah, I thought that might be the case. Yeah. It's maybe because of when I grew up. I want people to be exploring space. I do not like this idea that, well, we need to explore so we can, you know, abandon, spaceship Earth one day when we need to. No. But I just think, yeah, it's cool, these incredible achievements with satellites and, you know, ships, spacecrafts landing, unpersoned spacecrafts landing on planets and meteors. But I still think there's something neat about the, after all, I played astronaut, for God's sake. So, you know, we have to get people into space. Mm-hmm. So one day, Darsa, one day you'll be there. That'd be a good J term, maybe, you know, January term at Gustavus. Final frontier with you. And all right. Congrats on the award and the forthcoming essay. That all sounds exciting. And this is really fun. And look forward to chatting more when we can on campus. So thanks again. Take good care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.